Hello, and welcome to the 38th Planet Destiny podcast. We have the normal crew here. We have Pope Bear, Briar Rabbit, Tefty, and we are honored to have an extremely special guest. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey, everyone. I'm Luke Smith, the director for Destiny the Taken King. Thanks for having me on.
We're super excited. Yeah. We're excited to have you on here. We have literally a seven-page a codex of questions that was created by the community. And yeah, we have a grimoire of questions here. We're just going to start diving right into them. So for any unfamiliar listeners, people just tuning into the podcast for the first time, people are just interested in Destiny. What do you do at Bungie?
Well, I'm just a simple man trying to make my way in the universe. But right now, that universe is really about, you know, we just came off of shipping Destiny the Taken King, that the new game in the Destiny universe that I was the creative director for. And so what that really means is a whole bunch of people at the studio do a bunch of amazing work, and we're, you know, I'm helping unite and drive the vision for the project and get everyone sort of on the same page about where we're going for the release and what type of fun we're going to deliver into players' hands as a team.
How many years have you been corralling the cosmic waves of creation at Bungie now?
Oh, geez. I started off at Bungie in May of 2007, and what I was doing then was sort of writing jokes for the internet. I was working, you know, on the community team. I was the content editor and was working on BNet. I wrote some weekly updates, and I hosted a podcast back in the day, the Bungie podcast. And I did that for about a year, and then after that, I ended up sort of getting roped into some early design work for Halo Reach, where I worked on the challenge system, the armory, I was sort of the investment designer for that, our first sort of foray into investment systems. And then after Halo Reach came out, I moved on to the Destiny project and was working on a bunch of stuff, and then transitioned to the raids once we and took over the raids and hired and grew that team and worked on some other stuff, and then Vault of Glass. And then after my work finished on the Vault, I moved on to the Taken King.
So everything I love about the video games you've worked on, except for... Did you work on Armor Lock and Reach?
No, but I famously or infamously talked about how much I liked Armor Lock, but it's generally, I feel like for me, the lesson is like generally when I like something a lot, it might mean it's a little powerful.
Did you design the Sunbreaker strong. Titan?
No, our sandbox team did an excellent job with the old Sunbreaker.
No, you know, it's funny that I remember back when you were doing the podcast in the Bungie podcast, and really that is what got me into. I had never really gotten into podcasts before then, and listening to them because there was a Bungie podcast. I started exploring what other community podcasts were out there, and you know, so. Those early days of that are really what kind of got me into doing this medium of getting involved in it, just listening at first, but then, you know, eventually wanting to be on my own.
Yeah, the podcast game's fun, man. I've felt generally really comfortable just doing it. I'm sitting here shooting the shit with folks, like the, you know, the Kotaku interview that I did a few weeks ago, and then the... you know, the One Up back in my much younger days, doing the One Up Yours podcast with the One Up folks before Bungie. And that was, you know, those guys were some of my dearest friends. And that was a lot of fun. I think it's funny. It's sort of like become it's like much bigger now than it used to be, but this like notion of just a bunch of people sort of hanging out, and you get to sort of sit and listen in to them just hanging out, shooting the shit, talking about something you're hopefully interested in is pretty damn cool.
That
cool.
One Up Yours podcast was a defining moment for me. It's like, cause you guys were so good. You, Garnett Lee, who else was on that? Shane Bettenhausen, Shu came on there every once in a while, right?
Yeah, it was John Davison, Shane Bettenhausen, Garnett Lee. My buddy Andrew Pfister was the producer, and then we had like guest stars like, you know, Mark McDonald, Shu came on occasionally. That was just a lot of
that
fun.
It was a lot of fun to listen to, especially when you got the MPD numbers.
Oh gosh. Oh yeah.
So I think we wanted to move into some of the other questions here. Briar, did you want to lead in some of just the general Destiny related questions that we had from our team?
Yeah, we got a lot of questions about you know, kind of going back to like House of Wolves, a lot of people got upset when you guys didn't announce or you announced that there wouldn't be a raid in House of Wolves. We were wondering if you could talk about that decision to not include a raid in the DLC. Like, how did that kind of decision get made, and what did you guys do with that while you were thinking about it?
So I just want to clarify the back part. What did we do with, like, the, you said, what did you do with that? What is the that modifying in the question? Like, what did we do with the plan to not announce that, or to announce that we're not doing a raid?
Well, was there a raid initially going to be released with House of Wolves? Did it get canceled? Did it get postponed? And how did you guys think the community would react to it?
Well, anytime the community's expectations are always going to exceed sort of what we can deliver, and I think our job with Destiny is to continue to try to like rise up and meet those lofty expectations. But there was the raid, you know, any sort of raid that we wanted to build for Destiny, like we had to find the right place to release it, and our appetite for what we wanted to do after Curta's End was so large that the vehicle for that, what it was going to be a major release like the Taken King. The raids are not, I mean, no one's going to like hearing this, but raids aren't a promise. Like it's not a promise. We're gonna build them to the best of our ability and release them when we have them ready. And
don't
you know,
you say that, Luke Smith. Don't you say that.
that takes time and effort. And you know the like it's yeah you know, we'll put them out when we have
Did
them.
Did you
ready.
Guys start working on King's Fall after Crota's End?
Absolutely. Yeah, we worked on Crota's End and then King's Fall booted up King's Fall development.
So like there was no in between raid that had started and then got scrapped or shelved for later?
No. I mean, the closest thing to an in-between sort of raid was like a data file that was a tooltip that people like data mined, you know, of like something placeholder. Like I think there's this like danger in data mining and expecting it to be, you know, something that meets your expectations. Like I think that, you know, until you have it and see it in the game, it's not real. And so it's much easier to create a piece of placeholder UI than it is to create a raid.
Sure, yeah. And King's Fall, obviously, there's a lore that it follows. So was that the intention? Is that maybe this might be too big of a question, but is the arc of where you guys started with Fault of Glass, then going to Crota's End, and then into King's Fall, is that because of the lore or just because of what you guys are interested in right now as a team?
I think for me as the director for the Taken King, I wanted to create, I wanted us to create an experience for players that felt in the case of the Taken King, like sort of a single story, mm-hmm. basically a single thread where, you know, we would meet this threat and dispatch a part of it if you don't raid, and hopefully you have a satisfying conclusion. And then with the King's Fall, we really wanted to sort of elevate that and tell a little bit more of a story about Oryx and some of his like key lieutenants, and then have players ultimately tip this guy over and you know, send him where you send him when it's
right,
over.
You want to kill him and then realize that he's not dead and have him wipe you. That's what the plan was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good gotcha in there. Yeah. I think that was
a good gotcha.
That was a good gotcha.
Some good memories for folks. We had a guy in our group, as it happened, we were rushing to shoot the boss because we didn't, you know, I don't share really anything about the raid with my group of friends. I don't raid with people from work. I play with some of my personal friends. And so it's a process, raiding with them, a sometimes frustrating one, of the process of discovery for them. Yeah. And me sort of sitting quietly and trying not to be an asshole when they're inevitably floundering. But it also becomes a moment of learning because it allows me to see very intimately what people are and aren't understanding, which is awesome to learn from. But when we got to that moment, one of the guys in our group just blew himself up with a rocket launcher and we wiped, and we will forever blame him for that wipe.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, you played a pretty heavy role in the Vault of Glass, right?
I would say that's a fair assessment of my work, yeah.
So what do you bring into the experience? Because, I mean, right now you're batting 1,000 for me as far as raids are concerned. Can you take us through that process where you guys were deciding on how that was put together? I mean, did you get to build your team? Was it, you know, how'd that work?
We had built a bunch of stuff that was not in the Vault of Glass. We built a bunch of stuff that will never ship. But that process of building, it was an awesome learning process where we sort of started to uncover what we thought raids could be about. And the vault, we hired a bunch of the team while we were building the vault. But the initial thinking for the Vault of Glass, and I think at some point I'm probably going to do, I don't want to step on it too much, but I'm probably going to do a sort of longer form sort of breakdown of this. But I'll give you guys some of the outline. You know, we started with this place on Venus. We knew we were going to do something Vex. And we just were looking for sort of a key environment theme. And you know, Chris Barrett and I, Chris is a fucking super awesome guy, super talented, good buddy of mine. He was the director for DLC 2, and Chris and I have worked together for a long time, and he's been at Bungie forever. And Chris and I and Steve Cotton, who is now working on PvP and has long time been a PvP guy, were in a room just talking about the Vault of Glass as a place. Fun fact, the original name for it was going to be the Glass Throne. And I said, like, dude, the Glass Throne is like a toilet. Like, your Glass Throne is a fucking toilet. Like, we can't have the first raid in Destiny be named after a toilet. Like, that's... And so I changed it to the Vault of Glass. And we were just talking about just, like, some early inspiring words. And the word we arrived on was Descent. Mm-hmm. And so, basically, once we agreed that we were going to make the raid a Descent, and the concept artists, like, basically commissioned this, like, beautiful image that is the image that you see when you open the raid door at the end... We then set out to figure out what type of experience we were going to make. One of the early designers on the raid was a guy named Dan Miller. And Miller is super talented guy. He's made so much content for Destiny, and also like very prolific designer for Halo when we were working on that. And you know, Miller and I started talking about encounters, and we hired this guy early on named Gavin. And Gavin was the lead for Curtis End and also the lead for the Kingsfall raid. And Gavin is just he brought so much to the table for the team, and we started to, you know, by the time Gavin had joined, we had a pretty good skeleton, and we had basically walkable geometry. And I think one of the first things that, I mean, he'll like probably never want me to tell the story, but you know, one of the first things that Gavin worked on was the Gorgon maze. And I was, and by this point we had built the maze. And just as he was like spinning up on the tools, and he's like super technically savvy, he got up to speed super quickly. I was like, hey, the first thing I need you to build is I need you to place these Gorgons in this maze like puzzle, and they're going to instant kill you when they see you. And he's like, this is terrible. He's like, people are going to hate this. And maybe they did, and maybe they didn't. But the Gorgons for me was this moment of – it was a really important moment for the vault, because it was a moment – we had to have a moment of confidence building for us as developers. And I wanted us to really prove we could do something interesting without involving guns and involving silence. We have this before it. We knew before it we had this big sort of three-act movement. The Templar suite is the way that I refer to it. And we had this like combat-heavy Templar suite that has this frenetic action, and it builds and swells, and you have this guy who's shooting you, and he's immune. We have this like villain that we constructed, the Templar, and we constructed that villain so that you would see things like the Templar, you know, releases his minions, and you know, you felt like a character, despite just ostensibly being like a sort of like slightly gussied up Ultra Hydra. And we would have this moment where you would finally get to kill him in the final movement of this, like, you know, sort of this suite, the Templar suite. And I knew after that, like, I really wanted silence. I wanted quiet for the raid. So I wanted a maze, and I wanted a huge drop. So one of the things that we talked about when we were talking about Descent was, if we're going to do a Descent, you know, I want to play with that theme throughout. So I want the transitions in the raid, like the time to walk between combat spaces. It's really important to me that those be long, they be lengthy. The reason why, and I think some of this is like, I mean, I don't want to demystify these things too much, but some of it is because, you know, when you're on a journey with six people in voice together and you're not shooting, it actually forces you to talk and be in each other's presence and in this like social way, and be talking about your lives and your wives, your boyfriends, your children, whatever, like what's going on in your life. Because raids really at the end of the day are about like shared, you know, Yeah, shared effort, social experience, you know, shared loss is one of the things, like one of these ties that binds you into friends. And, you know, that's what the raids in a bunch of ways are about, which is about like the creation of friends and relationships. So I wanted the transitions between all the spaces to be long and memorable. And I think that, you know, when you look at something like Kingsfall really feels, you know, in a really great way, like an excellent child of some of the thinking that we've been pushing, you know, was pushing in the vault. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where sort of the theme. I was looking for some of your thoughts, and I'm really glad you're talking about some of the original thoughts on the Vault of Glass, because it feels like the Vault of Glass is sort of the genesis for like a not more developed, but the Kingsfall raid seems to take the ideas and things that I really loved for it and take it to a new level.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like you're right; those transition areas are so important.
Normally in like a transition area in, say, a World of Warcraft raid, I like the active choice of filling it with silence instead of what would normally come in between boss fights is just killing mindless trash mobs that are of no significance to the story, to the actual plot of the raid itself. It's just there to kind of be in your way. But here, we do have these silent transitions where you get to reflect on what you just did, what's going to happen. It's a very interesting to actually hear that explained.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's cinematic. I feel like you were talking about like suites and movements of the raid. It has a cinematic feel, which is excellent. And it definitely translated over into King's Fall as well. So well done.
It's a team effort, man. There's no like one person who invents everything.
No, Smith. Well done.
another moment. I mean, a moment where I remember people looking at me like I was crazy was with the death drop in the Vault of Glass. You know, I wanted to have this moment where the fantasy is, you know, the pit that you don't know how you're going to survive the fall, but down at the bottom of it, you can see like a spark of something, a spark of light down at the bottom, and that's lights the Gorgon. But that thing like pulls your eye and hopefully makes you feel like, oh man, the only way we can go is down, but I don't know how to survive this. And, That also had this property of explaining sort of fall damage and the way that you could mitigate it in Destiny if you hadn't learned it yet, but also hopefully created a moment for groups where they're like, where do we go next? Mm-hmm. Like, and someone in your group hopefully was like bold enough to say, I'm going to try to go down.
And
and that person makes that sort of leap of faith, and then everyone follows. And then this raid, which is, you know, previously, you know, all the phases leading up to this were basically about splitting up into groups of two and like occupying space and controlling space. In the maze, you have this section that asks you to, in fact, it punishes you for splitting up. It demands you stay together. It demands you sort of follow each other and through this labyrinth that I still think is probably pretty cool and pretty complicated.
I still get lost in it.
And then, This other thing that on the other side of that, again, another time when I think people looked at me like I was a lunatic, was the jumping puzzle. And it's a really simple one, but like these blocks that fade in and out of existence is like to me it's a little bit of a reference to one of the games that was really important to me as a child was Mega Man. Mm-hmm. And Mega Man 2. And so I remember those blocks from Iceman stage, but also crucially, you know, my gaming, I played a lot of Mega Man 2 as a kid, so I remember those blocks from Heat Man, and I wanted to have like a little 8-bit reference there. And you know, the whatever people call it, affectionately we've called it the dick wall internally in King's Fall. Mm-hmm. That's another another reference to one of my favorite 8-bit games in Double Dragon, which is when you're on your way, this is like totally, I hope this doesn't ruin it for people, but when you're on your way to fighting Machine Gun Willy in Double Dragon, you're in Machine Gun Willy's temple, much like you're in Oryx's temple, and you get to this place where these blocks start to shoot out of the wall, and they kill you and knock you off the ledge. And so I wanted to have something like that, but what is the, you know, the challenge for the raid team to solve is what does that look like when you translate it into 3D space? And you know, the Oryx to Machine Gun Willy, you know, metaphor is kind of funny. I haven't really necessarily intended that, but that, you know, again, just like these like little touches that are that are these things that are like strangely, I mean, strangely important to me, but I hope, like, I hope people have their own, they like resonate with people in their own way. I mean, that's sort of what the raids are about.
That wall really breaks up the raid for most raid teams I'm on because it always ends up with hysterical laughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's somebody that gets just shot across the, to the other side and just splatter. You hear go, and it's a wonderful part of that raid because you're so tense for the boss fights and you've got to work so, you know, you got to work together and just be on point all the time. And then all of a sudden somebody just gets shot across the level and it's just awesome and fun.
It's really
to be
fantastic.
There.
I really like the Golgoroth fight. I think the Golgoroth fight's probably one of my favorite fights that we've done. And, it's extremely intense. Mm-hmm. If you're one of the two taunters, it's extremely, extremely intense, and to then like have the wall sequence come out of that and infuse some levity into your group before the sort of, you know, stiff trials that await you on the other side of it, like really really great pacing.
And that's just it, we're cracking up laughing, right? Moments ago you were intense and like, you know, there was counting out seconds like a metronome, you know, like you're just trying to get everybody organized and there's this very intense gunfight. And then there is a cathartic moment where everybody, you know, is allowed to, you know, breathe and relax and do something fun, like jump around, you know?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's that pacing that pacing that you're talking about that makes you connect with the raid in a way that I feel like, the Dark Blower, I feel Crota's like Crota's raid just didn't have that to me. It felt quick and dirty.
We had a different sort of, I mean, we were trying to do something a little bit different with the Crota's End raid. And, you know, I remember vividly Gavin and I talking about it together and talking about we wanted something that feels like sort of more frantic, something that feels a little bit more urgent. And I think that in a bunch of ways we achieve that. And mm-hmm. I think that the raids all have this property, which I'm really fond of, which is they're each sort of their own. They're each their own dog, like they're their own entity. You know, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm going to tell this. As a child growing up, we always had golden retrievers, and they are like I have one now as an old fart, my dog Maple. And Maple is a golden retriever, just like Cedar and Lady and Murphy and Raleigh and, you know, my dog's grown up. And they're all golden retrievers. They have a bunch of properties that are the same. But each of these dogs has their own personality and their own style and their own type. And I think of the raids sort of in that same way, where, you know, all the raids are like golden retrievers. They all have like these common elements. We're figuring out, I think we're learning what the best pieces of those common elements are, but we want all the raids also to feel different. And so we want them to each have sort of their own uniqueness and the own thing that you remember from them.
You take a very personal approach to your work. It sounds like you're very, you're very, very, very passionate about it. You're bringing in things from your life and into the design elements. And, you know, I knew your reputation from Vault of Glass and how much work you guys put into that and the passion behind it. How much did some of the negative feedback that came out of, one, you know, not having the raid in the next DLC in the House of Wolves, but also like how, I just want to bring it up, but like you got a lot of negative feedback from your comments of like the throw money at the screen thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, you know, I know how much work you put into this thing and how much of you is in it. And how did that affect you and knowing that people were seeing you in this negative way? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I really appreciate the observation that you feel like the game has some like personality. I think that I appreciate that. I think that the stuff that excites me as a player, and a lot of it comes from, you know, my history in a bunch of games. But you know, it's for me, when people are frustrated, it's really, they're frustrated because they care. And when they're frustrated with me, you know, it's because they care about the product. I don't want to belabor the difficulty of creating entertainment because I don't think people care. Like I don't think people care about how easy or hard it is to create something. They only care about, you know, I'm here on my couch, I have a limited amount of time, and what I've chosen to do with my time is play in the world that, you know, we're shepherding and creating for Destiny. And so because time is like our most finite human resource, and time is a big part of engaging with the time you can engage with Destiny can be a big part of your life. It certainly is for me. The frustration is oftentimes related to that. And, you know, I don't want to talk too much about how that stuff can make me feel. The thing that I love so much about working on Destiny is that, like, Destiny is to me, it is my hobby. It's the thing that, you know, like, if I wasn't, you know, on the podcast with you guys right now, I would be playing, you know, I'd be playing, you know, probably be, you know, finishing my Taken War quest line on my Hunter so that I could get the 3-10 artifact, you know, for the character.
Mm-hmm. You're on as much as I am. You're playing this game a lot.
I'm on a lot, man. I've said in a couple interviews, and I don't ever want anyone to run the numbers on it, but if I looked at the time that I've spent playing Destiny as a player at home and playing Destiny as a developer of the game, and then going to work and working on Destiny and then adding sleep in, you know, there's not been a whole lot of time for anything else. And I don't say that for anyone's sympathy. I say it because I choose that. I've chosen this. Like, it is this thing that, you know, I was always envious of, when I was covering software in the, you know, mid 2000s, when I would hear the Blizzard guys talk about how much they played World of Warcraft, and I was so jealous of this opportunity to like create and also, you know, participate as a player. Like, I loved hearing from those guys and hearing how much they played. And when I look at Bungie now and think about Bungie the entity, and I see how much the people at work play, like, it's so exciting, and it makes me so happy to see that we have so many developers on the team who really are playing the shit out of the game. Like, these guys and gals are just like playing a bunch of it. And for so many of these players, and I think for so many of the Bungie employees, but also as well as our player base, I think Destiny is the first game of its kind for many of these players. And so they're sort of getting that, you know, I'll never forget. It will stick with me as long as I live. The moment when, after I created my Tauren Shaman, I stepped out into the Tauren starting area, and the moment where it hit me where, oh my God, those guys, those are other people. And up until that point, I'd really never experienced anything like that in games. And even in the development of the Destiny, the vanilla Destiny, like, that was a moment that, you know, that was a moment that I talked about in development, because it was a moment that I felt like we were going to be able to, we had this opportunity to create this moment for players in a shooter who have never played a game like this, and to, you know, help players see that other players can matter to them. And, you know, we haven't even come close to reaching our potential in that way, but, you know, we're certainly going to keep trying to get close.
Does everybody raid at Bungie? Do all the employees?
I'm not going to say everybody raids, but a whole lot of people raid. I mean, we have, you know, we have a lot of people who play the game and a lot of people who raid, and I think a lot more people both at Bungie and in the wild raid than I ever expected, I ever mm-hmm. hoped for.
It was one of the original draws to the game. Yeah, just the fact that it's coming mm-hmm. with this thing called a raid.
Yeah, what was the expectation at Bungie for when you guys built a raid? Did you realize how much of an endgame piece of content that was going to be? Or was it like, I don't know if the public is going to be on board with this non-matchmaking, got to collaborate extensively for several hours to get through it for the first time type of experience? Like, what was the experience for you guys making that and thinking how it was going to turn out?
I think a bunch of people at Bungie, I mean, the notion of putting me on the raid was probably a risky one that Jason Jones, the chief creative officer at the company and the founder of the company, that was his call to move me to the raids and have me take over that effort. And it was really totally by, you know, faith, and he and I working together on some of the initial, like, talking about the pillars for the raid activity and what we were chasing, you know, aspirationally. And he was then able to fly air cover basically for myself and the you know, raid team in its infancy. And we didn't always do ourselves any favors in development either. I mean, I am pretty, I think less so now because of my different role, but at that time in the raid team, I was extremely secretive about what we were working on. I didn't really share it too broadly, even internally. It was sort of like a, you know, early on, it was like basically a need to know basis. Like if you needed to know about this, we'd talk to you about it. But otherwise, we were sort of like, we were sort of our own group of rogue agents, you know, making something we were excited about. I remember getting up at one point in front of the team, and I asked our VizID team to make a video for me, because I don't like to get up in front of the, at this point in time, I didn't like the idea of getting up in front of the studio without something to show. And they're like, well, what do you want to show from the raid? And I said, oh, just the door. And he's like, what? I was like, yeah, I just want to show the door, and we're going to have the door open in the video, but we're not going to show how. And they're like, really? Like, this is going to be a really lame video. And I was like, I'm willing to take the chance. And what I did was I got up in front of the Bungie team, which, you know, is probably the only group of people in the world. And I've talked to many, many groups of people in my time on the planet that I still, to this day, get nervous to get up and talk to. But I got up in front of them, and I talked to them about the raid with this video playing behind me of the door sitting ominously. And at the end of my talk, which is about, a, you know, probably 2 minutes long, the door starts to open. And I said, now go up. Go back to your desks, get in groups of six, and figure out how to open it. And for many people, that was the introduction to raiding, and that was where it all started. Mm-hmm. And I think the moment where it clicked for Bungie was we were playing an internal development build during a winter, and we played leveled up characters and geared our characters for the raid, and came into the office, imported our characters that we'd spent time leveling up and gearing, and we raided and went through the raid together. And that was the first time that I think it really clicked for a broader group of people at the studio. And that was a pretty awesome moment for us. And I think in that moment when we were playing that, and, you know, killing Atheon, that was internally, like killing him internally with a group of, and this is not like a crazy high skill group of players, it's just a group of people, you know, willing to work together to try to solve the puzzle. That was the moment where I felt like, okay, like I think we got something here. I think we've got something that could be pretty damn special if we fix a bunch of bugs and make a bunch of stuff better. And after that build, for instance, we went back and we redesigned the Vault of Glass final space. That space used to be pretty different from how it is. That story is pretty funny, actually. I've talked a lot about stuff that I cared about for the raid and people looking at me like I was crazy. But a time when I looked at the designers on the project and thought they were crazy was when Dan Miller and Steve Cotton were like in a room, like drawing on a whiteboard. And Miller and Cotton came down and grabbed me, and they like wanted to talk to me about a pitch. And the pitch was the time traveling between, you know, the three timelines for the vault. And they had like a technical pitch for how they could do it. And Dan was really excited about it. And, just the verve and enthusiasm for those guys, like those guys had for it, was something that, you know, I was just excited hearing the pitch and was like, oh my God, like this sounds amazing. We have to do this. And, you know, Steve Cotton and Miller figured out how to make it work. And, you know, Steve, who works in the PvP section of the company now and has, and, you know, did in the Halo days as well. When Steve was starting to like think about what raiding could be and was trying to understand it, he kept coming back to this concept of tower defense. Like that's how he sort of, like that was the lens through which he was trying to understand the raid. And if you look at the environment construction for the Templar space, it has almost like tower defense, like lane mm-hmm. quality to it. It has this, but what that created for us is, as I mean, that what that space created was like this like mono directional combat that allowed you to orient yourself in the space, learn the space in the defensive phase before oracles, and you'd learn how to use the space. Oracles would teach you more about the space, right. And the Templar would challenge you to master it. So even in that first suite, we ended up with this like pretty cool mastery loop that players could develop and sort of feel like they conquered that first part. And I think that was another thing that we achieved, and the team really did a great job on.
One of the weird things about the Vault of Glass in the original game was that it never seemed to be a connected piece of the story of the original Destiny, like the vanilla game of Destiny. But in subsequent DLCs, it definitely does feel like Crota definitely feels like the end game for the Dark Below story. And with the Taken King, it definitely feels like a connected piece of the story. You said that it kind of got, the Vault of Glass got kind of developed in secret, kind of. Is that something that still happens, or do you kind of, is it now more connected? Because it feels like some of the strikes have different qualities that they teach you how to raid a little bit for King's Fall.
We definitely are trying to get to the place where the game feels like, it feels, you know, aspirationally, the game feels like a vertical learning exercise. And what I say when I use like those like nerdy terms is that the game actually teaches you mechanics as you go through it, so that the game feels like it's ultimately preparing you for its you know, final challenge. The difficulty in developing this way, which we're, by the way, like, we have not realized our potential for this, and I think we have a long way to go before we get there, also, to be totally transparent about it, is that it requires the raid teams to be functioning way further out than the releases, so that the raid team's mechanics are in place on, you know, we believe in them, so that those can trickle into the game, and we're not there yet. And I think that we had a lot of like ways to bridge the gaps between the teams, and I would say, you know, for King's Fall and the rest of the game, that was an area where I was able to help sort of, you know, massage some things together to, you know, try to achieve in that direction. But I don't think that we're there yet, and I think that, you know, we have a ways to go to making, you know, make the game feel like it's preparing you not only in the reward game, which I think we're getting much better at for preparing you for the raid, but also in the, like, teaching you about teamwork, teaching you about game mechanics, like, that, you know, you may find harder versions of later. You know, we have, and even that, like, here, to, like, not argue with myself, that's a slippery slope too, because part of the fun and the magic of raiding is like, ooh, what's going to be in this room? Like, ooh, what's this? Like, you don't want to, like, you don't kind of don't want to give it away. Like, you don't want to give away all the mechanics before they get there, so they just feel like they're fighting a different version of
Destiny
it.
Players talk about blind runs through your raids like they're religious experiences. Like, oh, true, I remember my first raid. It was 12 and a half hours long. It was arduous, but I had so much fun just learning the mechanics. And you're right, it'd be weird to take that away by teaching all the raid mechanics and strikes.
Yeah. So the thing, though, but that you guys are introducing, though, is that you're actually introducing mechanics into strikes now that are like raid light mechanics. And that's been interesting to see happen. And do you guys feel like you're going to go further in that direction? Do you feel like the strikes are at a good balance where they're at? And also, how did the team attack those and actually balance them? So it wasn't like if you got into a strike with two of the people that were clueless that you weren't going to be able to complete it.
I think we're still learning about how to do a better job with that. I think it was totally intentional that the strikes would offer a bit more of a challenge this time in terms of like challenging groups. But I think one of the things we're seeing, you know, players are quitting more, and you know, they're not finishing the strikes at the as quickly as we hope.
Like,
and
Echo Chamber,
you know, I think
Echo Chamber get a lot of
quit rates? Yeah. Echo Chamber is running a little bit long, and it's definitely being quit at a rate that's not super appealing to me. Mm. And that can mean any number of things. There's a number of things you can interpret or assume from the data, but the quitting problem is a real problem. And I think that we're going to be looking at speeding up our join in progress times for sure, for the strikes, but also, you know, the quitting the heroics or quitting the strikes is not super helpful to your common man. It makes the people left behind, you're, you know, treating them in this very disposable fashion. And I say that, like, I've left strikes. If I roll the same one, you know, like twice in a row or something, I might be like, yo, I'm out. Like, I'm not gonna do this, you know, five times in a row, Bungie. but this the disposable nature of matchmaking, which the strikes do and are gonna continue to use in the playlist for sure. Mm-hmm. That has like some pretty negative social properties as well, and so we got to continue to figure out, you know, ways to incentivize better behavior.
So on the heroics, do you think you're good? I mean, is the goal to include all of the vanilla strikes as well eventually, and add modifiers and have the Taken involved there, or is this how it is for the Taken King right now?
Right now, it's how it is. I think that it's like a cost benefit of, you know, going back and updating all the old strikes to use the sort of new variability. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of encounter work to do there, and it's not like you don't pay for that encounter work out of some like infinite bucket of fun. Right. You pay for that encounter work out of like something. You're like, should we like go back and redo Sepix or go make something new?
I'd personally love to see Sepix.
I think when people
Just saying.
Taking
Zephyrs away.
There's a lot of work required in doing that, and I think that we've got a pretty big appetite for doing new stuff too. So I think that seeing some more diversity in the strike playlist would be cool. I don't know that right now we're planning on like giving everything the Taken treatment, just because that is a non-trivial amount of work.
I think the new strikes, they're so much more engaging, and they're on a totally different level than I feel like they're on a totally different level than the strikes before. The teamwork that feel raid like in them. Now you're not gonna go back and update the previous strikes, but is this, you know, and have you considered like an opt out button in matchmaking where, you know, you're voting for a strike map or something like that to keep people from quitting out?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely talked about ways to make the matchmaking flow better. Nothing to really announce right now, but it's definitely something that's on our radar. In terms of the strike philosophy moving forward, you know, we are definitely going to be taking what we've done in the Taken King and applying that to the new stuff we're going to be creating. Like our, you know, we've got some pretty exciting plans for where we're going to take the strikes, and we are we're definitely, you know, sitting down to, like, you know, we're not resting on our laurels, man. Like, yeah. TTK just came out 3 weeks ago, but, you know, we're already back, you know, back in the saddle trying to work on our next stuff. And, you know, there's a bunch of timelines for things. Some stuff's close, some stuff's medium, and some stuff's far off. And we're off to the races on that at Bungie.
Awesome. I guess some of the people are that in some of the ways the questions were brought to us is they're afraid that you guys put a lot of effort into the Taken King because it was the first paid DLC, right? Your process for developing the content, the DLC contents that you're going to give it the same. Are we going to see more of the Taken King type, you know, quality content where we get story, where we get, like, you know, things that are that require cooperation? The strikes feel much more developed.
The thing I'm going to use to button that up a little bit is that the Taken King is not to us a DLC. Like, it's the beginning of a new year. It's a, you know, it's basically a $40 game. Right. Like, it's the 2.0 update is significant. It's a giant overhaul. We're not going to make giant overhauls like that, you know, in a non-major release, and then not a 3.0 or a 5.0 or a 10.0 or whatever. Like, those are that's a significant update. I think that we haven't really talked too much, and it's definitely not my place to announce our plans for the year. We're definitely changing the way we're thinking about, you know, content and releasing it, and we're gonna be looking at some different ways of doing things, I think, moving forward. And, you know, one of the things that we have to do is we have to keep, you know, breathing life into the game. And, you know, well, a great example of life is more content. So we're gonna keep trying to build and put out new stuff that people are excited about. Mm-hmm. But we also have, like, you know, we've restructured the company pretty significantly around Destiny and around the Taken King as we've continued to learn about what the game is. And, you know, we have a live team now, and the live team is basically, you know, the ball's in their court. You know, they've got plans and stuff that they're gonna put out into the world, and, you know, events that they're excited about. And we've, you know, we haven't yet seen the end of the Taken King content. Like, we have some more stuff planned. We haven't talked at all about hard mode. We haven't talked at all about some of the other stuff that we've got planned for the raids. We, you know, we've got
decals.
We haven't. there's some more fragments lying around.
Were you saying earlier that you were going to be announcing the sleeper simulant?
That's the most common question people ask right now. And I mean, I think there's I like often I think about putting something on my profile, but I realize people just don't read it anyway, which is like I don't answer questions like and it's not because I don't love and respect our fans. It's because I can't break into jail and turn Twitter into a Q&A format. Right. Like, I just, like, I can't do that, because then suddenly it's, you know, you answered his question, but not mine. Mine's way better. Why are you dodging me? Instead, I'm just like, I'm not going to answer any questions, because it's like getting yourself into trouble. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already enough of a problem for the PR team.
He said break into jail, so we can assume that we're going to have to break into the Prison of Elders.
Prison of Elders.
Gotcha. I get it. I get it.
Prison of Elders. Confirmed.
Once you have all calcified fragments.
Yep. We're good.
Hey, actually, speaking of rewards and unique loot and stuff, the strikes now drop specific things, which is really cool. Was that something that... not to reference another game, but was that something that was born out of Borderlands 2 and you guys thought that that was cool to do that for having a bosses drop specific loot, or was that just something that you guys felt needed to happen? You know, like, where did that come from?
No, that it's funny. That just came from like our desire to create reasons to run those strikes and items you hope drop, and like adding some like determinism for things that you could chase. Like one of our big themes for the release is you know more loot that you can chase and you know loot that represents your deeds. So when you get you know Maulers, you like see someone with those, you're like, I know what that dude killed. I know he tipped over those strike bosses a bunch to probably get those. Or when you see a guy wearing the red cyan flare cloak for the hunter, you're like, oh, that guy, like he probably killed the red cyan guy a lot to get that. Like that's cool. It's about that. It's about having some sense of place in the world for some of the gear. And I think that, you know, we're just taking, you know, we're taking these like baby steps into a much larger world that we're super excited to evolve and push going forward.
Yeah, I love that. I love that step and process, because it feels really exciting to find something unique from an element that you play a lot in the game, like Black Spindle showing up in a custom heroic mission. Mm-hmm. You know, that was brilliant.
That was so freaking cool.
Yeah, the Black Spindle thing came from one of our designers, a designer/engineer hybrid named Robert, and you know he had this great idea, and the fiction guys like supported it, and we had a great weapon that we set aside for it in the spindle, and you know I think that it's a great challenge. It's really really difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's a very difficult challenge. No one knew about it. I mean, is there more stuff out there like that?
There's a little bit more. I'm not going to overpromise it too much, but I think that the main thing to take away from it is, you know, like, you know, with Spindle and with, you know, some of the other stuff that we've blacked out of the data mine, you know, there's some more adventures to go on, and there's some more stuff that people can look forward to. And I think for us as developers, the lesson is like, and I think this lesson is sort of obvious in some ways, but it's like reinforced by the verve that people had for this. We got to do more of this stuff. Like look at the way people consume this. Look at the way they love it. Look at the way, you know, this gets talked about. Like, look at the conversation that this creates. This is an awesome experience, you know, and we need to provide more awesome experiences to players.
Wait, is it okay to have things that are just, you're just not good enough to get yet?
I think that is okay. I think that's very unpopular. I think it's probably very controversial, but I mean, I killed Nefarian in Blackwing Lair probably 56 weeks in a row.
Props.
And he never dropped Lakamir Ilramathis, and that was a mace from my shaman healer, and I wanted that mace so damn bad, and you remember the things that you like. You kind of remember the things that get away, like in this way that, you know, like not getting everything you wanted or not getting everything you want, like feels like crappy at this emotional level. And I really understand that. And I've been through that both in my real life and also in my like, you know, digital life with my characters, my little dolls that I like to push around various virtual worlds. But as impactful as the moment when you got the thing that you craved, like the feeling of loss and the feeling of not achieving and the feeling of like, ah, oh, if I had just, I wish I hadn't let that one get away. Like we all have feelings like that. And that's a similarly powerful emotion, as much as that emotion is not super comfortable for people, but like the, you know, I had to carry a friend of mine in the media through Black Spindle over the like last night, because he was going to raid today on a stream and he wanted to have it. And you know, I've known this dude for like a decade, and one of my guys and I got him through it with 4 minutes to spare. And he was like, how are you guys so efficient at this? And you know, we just slayed. Right. And that was awesome. Like, and he had a great time.
Like,
and
like,
you know,
made the game. What do you expect?
Well, I mean, that's the thing though. Here's the thing. Like, I don't want anyone, I don't want anyone to think that, like, because developers work on the game, they're any good at it. You know, the
but
like,
you did have 4 minutes like, left, so
we beasted it pretty hard. One of my buddies had a Galasord, and you know, Galasord and a Melting Point Titan's gonna turn the old Dixus or whatever his name is into mush. True.
So then that's kind of where I was confused with why the Three of Coins thing came up. And it just feels like those two concepts were out of sync with each other. They, you know, you would see somebody in the tower with that piece of armor or that sword or that gun, and you would have known their story and where they came from and what they had to do. And it really seemed like the Three of Coins idea was at odds with that. And, you know, it just felt like, you know, farming Three of Coins for exotic engrams really produced a lot of exotics for people that, you know, don't have that story now. They Draxxus is their story.
Yeah, I mean, there was a Guardian alert that day, it felt like, where, you know, suddenly all the Guardians in the world got, like, an emergency message from the tower that said, there's this guy in the House of Winter, and we really need to stop him. But to talk about the Three of Coins quickly, like, you know, Pope and I talked about this, you know, offline. It wasn't an exploit. Like, it was sort of, you know, charming to see the world declare that there was an exploit happening. Like, there was something that was definitely more efficient than we intended it to be. But we let it go out the door that way versus cutting it altogether from the game because we wanted to embrace the spirit of a more generous loot game. And I also, as someone who is really, I'm acutely aware of what's available in the exotic engrams and what's not aware. I also knew that a number of weapons, for instance, just aren't available in that way. So the economy of what players were getting ended up, and I think this is going to be a little designery, but the economy of what players were getting amounted to like saving them legendary marks. It meant that a bunch of the things that they maybe had already in year one that they were going to have to like save legendary marks and rebuy, they were getting a faster path to acquiring that. I was okay with that, and I take full responsibility for the Three of Coins, and if people are frustrated with it, they are like, I happily will take the ire or the frustration or the feedback on it. I'm gonna stand in front of the team for that. And if there's anything in the game that people like, it's you know, it's because the team at Bungie did a great job. And if there's anything in the Taken King that's frustrating, you know, I take full responsibility for it because it happened on my watch. Now, I think that the spirit of the Three of Coins is excellent. Like, I think it's great. I think that the retuned implementation is a dramatic improvement. The vision for this object, this item, was that it was a way to make running strikes, you know, more rewarding. Like, it's fun to see a gold engram pop out of a guy, and there's an efficiency that can be found there that's just gonna still make it fun, and it's also gonna have a property of like, this is gonna be another thing for you to spend your strange coins on. And also now, I mean, people have sort of got the reveal that if you're above of light 300, you have a shot at these 310 mm-hmm. exotics. So that's going to make getting these engrams and using these Three of Coins and, you know, on strike bosses and stuff, like, that's going to make that another appealing avenue to chase for the selected number of items that are in there. Now, a weakness of this system and something this exposes is that, for instance, if you play a hunter, and just for full disclosure, I have one of each class. They're all in the Pope knows. They're all in the post 296, 300 area. I don't fence a lot of gear around, really. I sort of build each character as uniquely as I can. I fence some weapons around, but this means that now, you know, I'm going to get to this point in my progression where I need to, like, you know, I need to find these higher level versions, or I may want to find these higher level versions of exotics to infuse, and, you know, like, that I'm gonna have to find more stuff, and that's all, you know, the journey's not over, and there's a lot of stuff to still find. But I think it was a shell shock for players to like see these exotics. Now, the reason I mentioned I was a hunter is because I was going to talk specifically about the chest slot, which is, you know, there aren't very many exotic chests in the game for hunters. Right. I think right now, currently, there's only the one. So if you decrypt it on your hunter, you're extremely likely to get an Alpha Lupi. Mm-hmm. And I think there's only one on the Titan. I think, in the game currently, there's just the Crest of the Alpha Lupi for the Titan. So if you get an exotic chest, it's going to likely roll into, and you're on a Titan or a hunter, it's going to roll into something in the Alpha Blue Pie family. Right. So maybe you should be passing that off to your Warlock, because I think the Warlock has three chest options. And so, but there's this, like, there's this economy, and I don't expect players to have it, and I think that it's sort of our fault on the development side for us to, you know, like, not actually, you know, not, I don't necessarily think we should advertise the potential of what's inside, but we, like, have to be clearer about you know, what could come out of this in some way, maybe.
Well, but, and here's what it did for me. And this is, I was drunk with exotic engram, like the exotic engrams, you know, like they're raining like manna from heaven, you know. And so I'm at Xur, and I'm just like, yeah, I'll buy him, you know. And I came out of the first year with like 2,000. Patrick, how many did you have strange coins?
I stopped at 1,800.
Yeah. So we had a lot of, you know, strange coins, and I'm spending them, right? I'm spending them, and I'm drunk with like, oh, I'm Draxus, you're going to give me engrams, all the engrams. And then it dawned on me, I'm like, wait a second, that's exactly what they want me to do. they wanted me to do. They wanted me to spend all my strange coins, and sure enough, guess what no longer motes, but strange coins. And it's, you know, it's really interesting how the economy sort of shifted.
There is one topic that's really similar to Three of Coins while we're on the subject.
Yeah.
Is like the Moldering Shards that came up in the raid. This is the first time we've seen anything like that come up in a raid type mechanic, is these Moldering Shards, where you kind of progress along in the raid. You pick these things up and, oh, what the hell are these for? Oh, you read the tooltip and looks like I'm going to get extra loot if I have X amount of them. But I think right now in the community, there's like this frustration around it, because it's not, yes, it's not giving them. I think that's also,
you trade in 20 for 2.
Yeah.
How does that economy work with them?
It has the ability to look at the loot tables for the raid and give you something.
You don't have.
Well, it can bias toward giving something you don't have, but it's not always going to be a win. And one of the rewards you can get from bosses is the 2 Moldering Shards. And so, you know, sometimes you're gonna lose. I think the lesson, I think a key lesson for us from Moldering Shards, which I think are a great idea, is the actual implementation of the understanding the Moldering Shards and what you're getting from them. Like, the, you know, you get the orcs, you get the rewards from the chest, and then if there had been like a second chest that was the Moldering Shard chest, you could understand like, oh, this is exactly what I got. I think there's not a lot of clarity necessarily, yeah, for what you got when you from your sort of bonus roll. And I think that there's a lot of like misconceptions in the ether about like, oh, it's double loot. Like, it's not double loot. Like, the first time you go to orcs, you're guaranteed a weapon, and right now it seems like he's oftentimes giving you double weapons your first time, and that is not intended. So you're sort of getting a free bonus there already. That's a bug. And so, like, there are definitely some improvements that we need to look at making to the loot. But when I look at the overall economy for Kingsfall, it feels so far, like, anecdotally for me and for watching some of my buddies gear up, it feels, you know, pretty okay in terms of volume. I've said, you know, on GAF and other sites that I agree that it can be frustrating to get a 300 power item from the raid, but also it's likely that you don't really have, I mean, a lot of players who aren't in that top 1% are going to not have a 300 item anyway. Yeah. So a 300 item is still just another piece of infusion material. And I think that we, you know, we're going to continue to experiment with loot tables and the way that we structure the raid rewards. And, you know, we've done something a little different every time. So
this feels more random than the Crota's End drops did. The Crota's End drops felt like I was constantly getting gear I didn't have. This feels like I'm more often getting gear I do have.
No, I mean, I believe I asked the tables to be adjusted late in the project to be closer to the Crota's End tables. Mm-hmm. So that was that experience I thought felt pretty good.
Okay. Well, small sample size right now.
Yeah. Yeah, small sample size.
I mean, three also, raids, I mean, the exact same chest piece for me, and, you know, where's my pitchfork? I'm going to march on Bungie.
I got the boots pope. We should talk.
So I do have a question about that. Is that on one character?
Yeah.
3 weeks.
Yeah, I got the boots 3 times.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, and I got the chest piece 3 times, like, and the same is actually the same rewards. every time. The Titan Mark and the chess piece from Crota or from Oryx. It was almost to the thing. The only thing that was different, instead of getting the auto rifle, I got a fusion rifle. And so, but everything else was exactly the same the every three times.
Hmm. Yeah, the same power level too?
No, all the power levels were different.
Same perks?
Perks were the same. Yeah. It's really super random, right? So that's why I wanted to ask you. Is my RNG really that bad?
I hope that it's that bad, but I think it's definitely something that we have to look at internally.
I have not experienced
to
that.
To see what's
going on. Yeah, and I wasn't going to bring it up as like.
Well, it's rare when someone says I got it. Like people don't go to the internet to say I got exactly what I expected. Like you don't go to the internet to say like I played this thing. My expectations were met, if not exceeded. like the internet doesn't exist for that. The internet exists to go, I did not get what I expected. This did not meet my expectations. I am here to
Bungie,
share
please.
Your profound missing of my expectations.
Somehow I gotta say too, I'd be bummed out if I got like all four raid pieces of armor in my first four raids.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
It's something that I'm like looking for. It's like it's the reason to keep going with the raids. Besides, you know, hanging out with six friends or five friends and having a great time in the raid. It's like that driving force constantly looking for that next piece of gear. To get it all right off the bat would be a little bit disappointing.
Right.
Well, I think that you say disappointing, but other people say like, I only want to play it once and I want to get everything.
Yeah.
And there's like that, like it's just expectations and the sort of the type of game that we're making and the type of game that people think they're playing.
And one of the things I've noticed is that you're not going with the archetype of like super, you know, you don't need any other gun but the vault of glass guns, you know, setup. Where those guns were just amazing and, you know, you fell in love with them because they were that amazing. I can't think of a vault of glass gun that wasn't amazing. Well, the rocket launcher.
Atheon Zeppelin?
Okay, so two of the guns. But you went away from that because I don't feel like the raid guns are as remarkable.
One of the more situational arsenal, basically, like I think that if you're running, I mean, for me, I think for my money, if you're running a cocoon sniper and a cocoon heavy machine gun in the raid, you're probably in pretty great shape. Yep. And you can choose whatever primary you want. I think that we've got the primary weapons in the game right now, I think are in a really great spot. I think that we have a pretty awesome lineup of exotics, man. I think that I love a bunch of our exotic primaries. I love a bunch of our legendary primaries, and the idea that we would have created a raid primary that overshadowed everything like Fatebringer or Vision of Confluence did, that would have felt like a regression away from some of what I've talked about, you know, and it's really important to me, which is that like creative customization, the horizontal progression. Like I was legitimately excited about the Suro scout rifle I got last night, that had Outlaw on it from Arms Day. And
it's a really good role.
And if I had a raid weapon that overshadowed that, then
what's the point?
Legendary marks.
It wouldn't have been exciting. Yeah, and
without re-rolling stuff, I mean,
yeah, is that kind of why we saw the disappearance of the reforging? Because it was just too hard to get better stuff after a point.
I think that reforging took the fun of getting weapons and had you getting a weapon and standing at Banshee trying to get a perfect hopscotch pilgrim, and I don't like behaviorally that. And I did a bunch of it. You know, it also had this, like, I think it had really negative connotations for the PvP game too, which is like suddenly every shotgun is a sniper rifle.
You had to have
and I think that we're
on everything.
Yeah.
And you know, I just don't think that's the right thing.
It seemed like such a good idea when we heard about it. Man, we were so excited. On this podcast, I bet we talked about it.
For basically once it was announced, we're like, oh my god, we're gonna be able to perfectly build our loadouts. This is great. Everyone finds the absolute best possible build, and it's gonna be really similar to each other. So everyone's gonna be running that shot package.
It takes the excitement out of a loot based drop system.
Like, oh, absolutely.
When you get that perfect roll, like I got a 1,000-yard stare that had two of the perks I really wanted. And the others, not so much. But I was really excited about those two perks.
Yeah.
You know, so I think I'm going to lose my shit if I find a 1,000-yard stare that has everything I want.
Yeah.
And,
well, like,
yeah.
I got an Imago loop from which is the white legendary hand cannon that's based on the Fatebringer frame, and I got an Imago loop that had Outlaw, and I was like, oh my god, oh my god, because I know the second slot can roll Firefly. I'm like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. And the second slot rolled like Airborne, and I was like, "God, shit!" Like it, like the near miss, yeah, right? Yeah. Like that, like that was. And I'm like, "Oh my gosh!" And now every time I run a strike, and it's a Vex strike, I'm like, "Oh well, hopefully I get an Imago loop because I can like pull my, you know, I'm pulling the slot machine and hoping that I can get that sort of Fatebringer sequel that I know is out there. Like I know it's out there in the ether, and that like that makes some of that to me as a player." Exciting, not in the like I'm only going to grind for it, but exciting in the like in the background this could totally happen. That's exciting, yeah. In that sort of way.
Yeah. Also, Arms Day would have been a complete disaster if you could reforge everything, you know, without that element of getting rolls with it, because then it would have been like, what's the point? You get the weapon once, then you wouldn't need it anymore. But also with the infuse system. Which I think is great. I think the infuse system is fantastic, what you guys have done. It breathes a whole new life into all the drops as well. Because now it's not just getting another legendary that you're either going to scrap or ascend. It's like this is materials to use for things that are important.
Yeah, the intention behind the infusion system was to create an arsenal economy that was really about making every drop as important as we could. Right. Even a blue drop can be important. Like I can be psyched about a 298 heavy weapon blue that I otherwise wouldn't care about. And like, cause I can look at that and go like, oh my God, I can throw this in the vault. And when the gunsmith finally sells a Suros rocket launcher, I'm like, oh, I have a thing set aside for it. You know, I got this thing lying around for it. I'm excited about that. And that's like I really like that. I really like that system and some of the behaviors that it allows us to create for players. And I think that we have, you know, like we did a bunch of, I mean, the art and the design team did an amazing job with the foundries. Yeah. And I think we're just sort of dipping our toes into these foundry weapons. Mm-hmm. And this is a new thing for
also
the IP.
The sound
and we're
too,
like,
the sound design and stuff is fantastic.
The audio is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I'm like legitimately excited that that I can order a Suros DIS 47 for next week, because it is on my like want list. Like I'm basically always on the hunt for an ideal legendary primary. Just as a player, I'm always looking for that like perfect legendary primary. Even though I have a bunch of exotics that I like, and a nicely rolled DIS 47 is one that I definitely want to play with, try out, see how I feel about it. That's why the Suros 43 with Outlaw was so exciting to me, because I personally like Outlaw as a talent. I think it's a lot of fun. It like alleviates some pressure on some other slots for having a reload perk on a piece of gloves. And so like I was excited about that, and I was like, that's why I like tweeted about that, because it's like, oh man, like this might be, you know, this might be something that I'm keeping around for a little while. And I get excited about that stuff just like our players, because I just am one.
Well, one of the things that we can like talk about before we leave the tower, I guess, in our conversation, metaphorically speaking, but we're seeing the economy shift a lot, actually, to legendary marks. And one of the things that came out in the weekly update is how the Iron Banner will be now, the economy of it will be legendary marks. What I'm noticing now is I'd say the ways of getting them are, there's the weeklies and the stuff. Is this the way that we're going to start seeing things being purchased, is through legendary marks solely?
We got to a place last year where Vanguard and Crucible marks meant nothing. They like everyone was just sitting on a bazillion of them, and they didn't feel important, and you know they weren't something that even asked you to make a decision about spending them. And like, you know, some of what we're doing is we're trying to create decision making, and we're trying to ask players to, you know, make choices about their arsenal, like make choices about what to infuse, make choices about, you know, what to purchase, make choices about what to do with your motes of light. Do you want to, you know, spend a bunch of them to level stuff up quickly, or do you want to like have a little stockpile for infusion? You know, we're trying to create choice, because it's through the opportunity for choice that players become more diverse. And so, you know, that is sort of our aspiration for that. I think that the the legendary marks are an example of us saying like, hey, we're gonna want you to save and use these things and make decisions about what you want to infuse. And
as far as I, you know, when I'm looking and preparing for Iron Banner, for example, I guess the drop rate is there's supposed to be a higher drop rate in Iron Banner that we won't that will be our primary way of getting the equipment, right? And we wouldn't be grinding through to level 5 so we can buy all this stuff. So I guess it's still to be determined what that actual drop rate looks like. But with 200, with only being able to save up 200 marks, you're not going to be able to depend. Obviously, it depends on how much things cost. But if we look at the economy, it's going to be about 100 and, you know, 20 for armor and 150 for guns. It just seems like we're not going to be able to save to purchase things.
Well, if you look in the update as well, armor and everything's going to drop much more frequently from actually
You know, my point is that we
save up. Sounds like we're going to have to make decisions on what we buy instead of just buying everything he's got for sale each week.
Yeah. I'm all for that personally.
I mean, you could also save up legendaries and then max out their XP and then dismantle them for 5 marks each. So there is a little bit of economy that you can store in the vault if you are worried about your marks.
Look at this dude just optimizing. Listen to
this
you.
This is how I think, guys. I've got my upgrade pass for my rares. You know, this is how I think.
Save your motes alike. Don't use motes alike to level up your factions. Use those things to level up your weapons. Get more mark. That's what I've been doing.
There you go.
I have no problems being able to grind out marks now just because I can put... Motes of Light seem like they're really easy to get now. Like, leveling up the Cryptarch gives you 5. Turning in your daily bounties, you know, will usually net you 1 per bounty. It's sometimes 2 or 3. For the amount I play, I'm definitely swimming in them, but the average player should be able to easily get, you know, like, 30 to 40 in a general play time of probably about 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't be too difficult.
Okay.
I want to say that I really enjoy this economy that's happening right now.
Yeah.
Because in the past raids that have locked us to a type of upgrade material, mm-hmm. that's had a very two-sided sword or two-sided blade to it that some people like, some people don't. I mean, there's a definite gap or a doorway that you have to walk through in order to get those materials to finally hit level cap. Whereas this, you know, we get to use all these materials, all these currencies, and then hope for better drops of light level. And I really enjoy that system. I'm enjoying that. So I just want to say that.
Well,
that's cool. I'm glad that folks are enjoying it. And, you know, we're going to try to keep watching and continue just to make stuff better. I mean, we're going to learn a lot from the Taken King. Mm-hmm.
So Crucible has seen a lot of changes since before the vanilla launch. Alpha and beta were, like, you know, of course, very different than what we see now. Bungie's pedigree has been from Halo in a very competitive scene. And it almost feels like Crucible is seen not as something that was intended to be competitive in like that environment, but more of just like a fun place to go shoot each other. Is it been a change? Are we still looking at a direction for a competitive Crucible scene, or,
you know, depending on who you ask at the studio, you'd get a different answer. And anytime there are questions like that, it says to me that we need to, you know, in studio leadership, we need to do a better job of getting aligned as a unit, so we can get the Crucible and get PvP into its state. I would say that one of the like two key pieces of learning for us in PvP in the last year is the importance of events. And when I say events, I mean like Banner and I mean Trials. You know, like, I think Trials is one of the coolest things that we've added to Destiny. Yep, you know, in that first year, and like it, you know, it. Like, I miss it right now. I'm glad that we put it on ice for a little bit, and I'm excited for us to see it return in October. I'm super psyched for, you know, 2 weeks from tomorrow for me to, you know, get out there and get back in with the band and see if we can still make it to Mercury in our new with the new matchmaking stuff. So I think we're like Trials to me is as competitive as anything Bungie's ever made in terms of emotional competition, in terms of intensity. I think it is the most intense PvP that Bungie's made, and I say that as someone who has like thousands of Team Slayer games, you know, under my belt. So it's just one man's opinion that Banner prioritizing victory, you know, last year like it did, I think was good. It like helped people see that winning matters, and I think that, you know, we're going to continue to learn and figure that out. I think that, you know, we have a game that's extremely extremely complicated in terms of the player inputs that you have, because it's important to us that you have a guardian, and you can, you know, take that guardian that you power up and geared up into all the activities, and that means Crucible, but that also means there's a lot of variability that I think for, you know, hardcore competitive players in a shooter, you know, that variability sometimes contributes to them feeling like the game's not competitive, because it's hard to predict the engagements and therefore understand the outcomes. And so I think we're still straddling some of the two worlds there.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're seeing is in the last you know, couple months, where there's sort of underground competitive PvP scene that's been popping up. And we're seeing some of that transition into like Inferno playlists and banning certain weapons. I guess that's really the question is, how much is Bungie embracing that, you know, competitive scene where we can watch, you know, you referenced it right there. You can't really have a competitive scene with the rule sets and stuff that we have now. And
no custom, you know, matches.
Are we talking about custom matches? And that, I guess I wanted to have it more than just a simple question of, you know, are we going to get custom matches? But is the direction towards a, you know, having that competitive scene and private matches, spectator modes, you know?
That's a great question, Pope. And I'm going to actually just dodge it completely, because anything I say about it is going to be scrutinized. Yeah. To infinity, and I could potentially sign people up for work that's not my place to sign them up for it. Right. So so one of the things you said that I do want to react to is, you know, I want to live in a world where, you know, I come home from a long hard day's rocking at the office and can fire up the old Twitch. Yep. And see that a more watchable Destiny, a Destiny that is more popular on Twitch, and, you know, I think it's already, we're very popular and satisfying emotionally, but, you know, I'm jealous when I see your Hearthstones and your Counter-Strikes and these games, the Dota, you're watchable. You know, when the raids come out, there's always an awesome spike in the watchability. And I think that's cool, but we've got to continue to sort of look inward at the development team and talk about, well, you know, how can we make PvP more watchable? What can we do for other parts of the game to make it more watchable? I think trials is very watchable. Mm-hmm. Yes, in a bunch of ways, but I think there are definitely some presentational things that we could do to continue to make it better. I don't want to run my mouth and sign anyone up for work.
Yeah, I'm okay with it. I mean, just go right ahead.
No, just keep going, man.
No, that's good. You
know, custom matches is like whatever.
Yeah, the teams have their own. The teams have their timelines and their plans, and, you know, we spent, you know, I had a solid period of time to set some direction and course for us, and, you know, that was awesome, and I'm honored at the opportunity to do it, and hopefully the Taken King and 2.0 are making Destiny better, and, you know, now we're going to be working toward, you know, those next updates, you know, the major and the minor.
So your role as a creative director of Taken King, did it encompass PvP maps that we saw? Was that sort of in your bailiwick? Did you oversee all of that?
I saw everything, but yeah, I mean, I saw everything. Like I said before, if you like the maps, it's because the PvP team did an awesome job. And if there are parts of the maps that are frustrating, you're more than welcome to burn me an effigy.
No, I mean, the rift mode is like, on my watch. I just love the fact that we're, you know, I was one of the loudest people bitching about not having capture the flag. Right? Can you tell us the genesis of Rift and how that came about?
I think, I mean, it came from the PvP team's desire to create an objective mode, and I certainly had that enthusiasm as well, which, you know, hopefully helped play some part in inspiring those guys. But the, I mean, those guys are hardcore PvP players, and you know, they felt that sort of hole in their hearts for the objective mode as well. And for me, you know, when we talk about watchability, I don't think you can learn a whole lot about how to get better at a game, which I think is a huge part of watchability, by the mm-hmm. way. Like watchability is really the ability to understand what people are doing and how watching them is going to make you better. That's the fantasy of watching a bunch of these things, is I'm going to watch Triple Rec play PvP because I'm going to learn something from him that can make me better. The place where this gets challenging is that when the primary avenue for skill is it's just slaying, like just playing Slayer, like you find that you like there's a ceiling, like there's a cap on what you can do as an individual. There's a cap on your own skill. You're going to get to a place where like, you know, I'm only going to ever be so good at slaying. But when you have, you know, objective modes and objective gaming and someone can carry the rift and you can be an amazing rift runner without having to pull the trigger, you know, and you can learn a route for carrying the rift. And, you know, I'm talking really aspirationally, not necessarily in terms of what we've achieved, but that's the ground that an objective game mode can pave, which is like the opportunity to learn and to, you know, like strategize and plan and see something people do and mimic it on your own. It's like it's the same reason why, yeah, it's like part of the reason why when you're a kid you watch sports, because you're watching sports, you're watching your idols, you're trying to form your jump shot after Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant or whoever, as you're watching because you're trying to get better. And it's really similar in a bunch of cases for streaming. I think that's part of it for streaming. I think there's this other part, like when you look at a bunch of our streamers, like, you know, folks we've had on for sure, you know, Broman and Gathalion, Lauren, Triple, like these are like super entertaining individuals as well as, you know, skilled players. And so that entertainment component is certainly another part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the opportunity, I don't want to underplay the entertainment at all. In fact, I've spent a lot of my like free time or unwinding time at my, you know, in my bed and my laptop watching streamers, and at some of it's just to, like, you know, hear them conversing, and, you know, you like, it's like you're not just like lying around alone. You're part of a community. You're part of something that's watching. So I don't want to underplay that. But in terms of that competitive streaming, you're watching, you know, competitive gaming for the spirit of like learning something, getting better. You know, I watch a lot of Dota. I love Dota. Dota is one of my favorite games, and I watch Dota because I want to see how people play and see what they're doing that I could be doing better. Like, oh my God, that guy's stacking creep camps. I didn't even know you could stack creep camps in that way. Like, I'm gonna try that. And that's that fantasy of, you know, I can get better at this. And our game needs to continue to provide better opportunities for that.
I know you're a creeper in the streams. You're a lurker, and as we call them, because I was doing a live stream for a charity live stream, and I realized how much you guys are involved in the community when you donated some money towards a live stream that we were running, and I started figuring out like that we had a bunch of the Bungie guys in there watching. And, you know, you guys have your times off and you're watching and listening. And I think that's a huge yep. part of it. But the questions that came out is just trying to make the PvP experience more competitive and, like you said, likable, watchable, and in a place where maybe a competitive scene will flourish in time.
We are nearing in, like, kind of about the time limit that we wanted to approach with this podcast.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, hey guys, like, I haven't had dinner yet, and it's like, I kind of have some Destiny to play before I go to the Martian tonight with a couple of my buddies, and I brought Thai food home, and it's getting a little cold, so yeah. I'm kind of winding down. I love talking with y'all. I would love to do it again.
I want to have you on at some point, and then just not, and just only have like Datto UI on, and then we just nerd out about World of Warcraft for like 2 hours straight.
No lie, I would love to do that show, man. I would love to talk about it. I think that, you know, I'd like to think I've said this in an interview already, but maybe I haven't. But I said to someone very recently, you know, if I were to die suddenly, you know, heaven forbid, you know, it would say Scarab Lord.
Yeah, you told me that when we were chowing down on food.
Yeah.
Last time I was in Seattle.
The reason why is because that is such a big part of what is important to me. What matters to me as someone who, you know, I'm very blessed to have the opportunity to even attempt to create entertainment for other people. And that, like, that part was that was such a huge part of shaping and influencing, you know, what's interesting to me. I've been doing a lot of research of past games and some stuff for what I'm thinking about, you know, for longer term stuff. And I'd love to get together and talk about, you know, old school MMOs and share stories with people. It would be, I mean, yeah, that would be fun. I could imagine talking about virtual worlds, you know, for hours and hours and hours.
Definitely. Well, we definitely thank you for coming on and sharing your wealth of knowledge about the game's development with us and our fans.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like we didn't get to enough questions.
I struggle with
brevity sometimes. Mm-hmm.
We reached out to our community and we had some of the writers for Planet Destiny pull in. And I'm going to share with you this document so that everybody listening, if we didn't address one of your questions, we're handing over the document to Bungie to Luke here, but it literally came out to just
it's seven pages, 12-point font, Arial, no double space, all single spaced. So
you'd be proud to hand it in to your English teacher.
Yeah. And it's crazy how much the community's passionate about this. The questions that they have are, you know, overwhelming, and we're you know, it's this flood of information from us because we stream live and we want to answer as many questions as possible. And we tried to hit as many of the big high points for people. And I know there's going to be people out there that didn't get their questions answered by Luke, but, I just can't help but be excited about the future if it continues to build and grow in this direction.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. It's just like, again, to reiterate, it's a team effort. And I think that Bungie's learning, you know, we're learning so much and we're never going to learn as fast as our community and our fans and our detractors even want us to learn. But we're going to keep trying. And we have, you know, we're continuing to grow the team, and we're, you know, I'm personally on the hunt for folks to be, you know, joining Bungie, and we're going to be continuing to sort of rearm and reload the studio. And, you know, we have this thing that, like, this game that people care about, and, you know, that's incredible for us to, you know, like, to have another franchise that people care about and love and, you know, want us to make better and push us to make it better, I think is such an awesome thing for us to have. And, you know, it really is a privilege for me and the rest of the developers to get to work on it, and to even have a community like Planet Destiny and the other satellite communities that spring up and have the opportunity for us to come on is something that, you know, if you step back from everything and think about when I step back from everything and think about it, and, you know, it's flattering and humbling, and I know the team feels the same way.
Awesome, man.
Well, awesome. Yeah.
We thank you for coming on once again. We thank everyone for listening to the podcast, and we will see you next week.
Oh, wait. I have one more thing I want to interject.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yesterday was Patrick's birthday. Oh, so God. If we can get...
Ooh, that's right.
If we can get 1,000 happy birthday comments in the comment section, that would be amazing. And happy birthday, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much, guys. Thank you very much. Yeah.